we will complete that. We will complete the study of these individual-driven harmonic oscillators, and then we will put them all together again to the quantum field theory, so that we can then see exactly how the classical charges and currents are creating photons, or in this case, Klein-Gordon analogs of photons. So where we will arrive at that point is that we have classical sources, classical charges and currents, creating excitations in a quantum field. And then we will start today upgrading this, namely going from classical sources to quantum sources. In particular, an atom can also emit light, and it can absorb light. So an atom can also drive the harmonic oscillators of the field, but the atom will be quantized. In fact, we can give the atom a fundamental role in this, because so far we had defined a particle as an excitation of one of these mode harmonic oscillators. We said that when the harmonic oscillator of a particular momentum of the Fourier decomposition of the field is in its fifth excited state, then we have five particles of this momentum. But that was a sort of rather theoretical description. Once we learn how to couple an atom to a quantum field, we can give a new definition for what a particle is. And we can say that the photon is what a photon detector detects. So a photon detector could be just an atom. So if an atom coupled to the electromagnetic field goes from its ground state to its excited state, then we can say, well, it captured a photon, right, with a particular momentum. So this is a different notion of particle. So today we will eventually, at the end of the lecture today, we will lay the groundwork for studying the light-matter interaction, how atoms emit and absorb photons. Remember, this is truly a second quantized issue. If you look at the ordinary Schrödinger equation for the hydrogen atom, then you find the hydrogen atom spectrum. It's, you know, the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. And if a hydrogen atom, according to the Schrödinger equation, is in its seventh excited state, it would stay there forever, because it's an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. It would never decay, according to regular Schrödinger quantum mechanics. It's only because it's coupled to the quantum field that it can decay. And that's because the seventh eigenstate of the hydrogen atom is not an eigenstate of the full Hamiltonian, of the hydrogen atom, the quantum field, and the interaction Hamiltonian. That's why decay happens. We will do that in the next lecture in detail, but today we will lay the groundwork. Okay, so we start out by completing the study of the isolated harmonic oscillators, the driven harmonic oscillators, classically driven harmonic oscillators. And then we will put all of them together into the quantum field. And once we have that, then we upgrade the description so that we have not only classical charges and currents, but quantum charges and currents that can excite the field. All right, so here, continuing now with the harmonic oscillators, the individual harmonic oscillators that make up the quantum field. So we are again just considering one harmonic oscillator now. Let us look at the energy eigenstates. Remember that in the externally classically driven harmonic oscillator, the Hamiltonian takes this form. We are working in the Heisenberg picture, therefore the operators are time dependent. The A of t is time dependent. The J of t is our classical driving force, and it doesn't have a hat on it yet, because it's a classical driving force. At the end of the lecture today, we will put a hat on that. Then we already calculated that the Hamiltonian at early times, before the classical driving force kicks in, takes this simple form. It's omega times a dagger in plus 1/2 at early times. And then we found the explicit formula in terms of an integral for what the Hamiltonian operator looks like at some intermediate time while the driving force is acting. And then we have this simple form again for the Hamiltonian after the driving force ends. And we also calculated the relationship between the A in and the A out operator. Remember, A in is the A operator at early time, and A out is the A of T operator at late times. The relationship between A in and A out we found to be very simple. A out is A in plus a constant J naught, that is the Fourier component of the driving force evaluated at the frequency omega, which is the resonance frequency of the harmonic oscillator. So now for, let us now look at the diagonalization of the Hamiltonian early and the diagonalization of the Hamiltonian late. Remember that the state is not evolving in time, the state of our quantum field, because it's the Heisenberg picture, but the Hamiltonian is a different operator at late times. And therefore, when we diagonalize it, we will have different eigenbases, because it's the early Hamiltonian is a different operator than the late Hamiltonian. So let's calculate those two eigenbases. And remember that these two eigenbases are both valid bases of the Hilbert space. And then we can ask, how is one basis related to the other? The transformation between the two is the so-called Bogoliubov transformation, and it comes up all over the place in quantum field theory. So we start diagonalizing the Hamiltonian at early times, which we already did, actually. So the Hamiltonian is takes this form in terms of the A in operators, and it is constant at early times before the driving force kicks in. And then using the A in and A in dagger operators, we can construct the eigenbases of our Hamiltonian as we did. And we have all of those basis vectors N in. They are eigenstates of the early Hamiltonian with eigenvalues En. The eigenvalues are the eigenvalues of every harmonic oscillator with frequency omega. They are simply omega n plus 1/2, as usual. Remember that these N in operators are generated from the zero in operator, from not the N in operators, the N in basis vectors are generated from the zero in basis vector, from the lowest energy state of the harmonic oscillator by applying the A dagger operators N times. And that prefactor is needed to make sure that this vector remains normalized, that all of these N in are normalized vectors. Right, and one can prove that the set of all of those n in vectors forms a complete orthonormal basis of the Hilbert space, a so-called Hilbert basis. Now, at late times after the force has done its acting, the Hamiltonian is a different operator and it is expressed in this form. We can do the same construction now, but for this different operator. We still have that the A out and the A dagger out obey the same commutation relations as the A ins did, but they're different operators. And we can now construct the eigenbases of the late Hamiltonian using the same construction as we did before, same strategy. In particular, just like for the early Hamiltonian, there's also going to be for the late Hamiltonian a unique vector zero out, which is annihilated by the A out vector. It must exist because the entire structure is the same, by the same commutation relations, the same form of the Hamiltonian. So the same strategy must carry through. It's just a different vector in general. Okay, so we can start with this vector again, and then we construct a whole Hilbert basis of eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian the same way as we did for the early Hamiltonian. And we simply get these vectors by applying a dagger to the power n on the ground state. Then again, one can show that the spectrum of the late Hamiltonian is given by eigenvalues en out, which are numerically the same as the eigenvalues of an in. And again, one can show that these vectors also form an orthonormal, in fact, Hilbert basis of the Hilbert space. So every vector in our Hilbert space can be written as a linear combination of either the n-in vectors or the n-out vectors. In particular, the n-in vectors can be expressed as linear combinations of the n-out vectors and vice versa. Since both of them are orthonormal bases, there ought to be a unitary transformation between the two. So in particular, the zero in vector has to be some linear combination of the n out vectors, because they form a basis. That's a vector in the Hilbert space. So there ought to be some linear combination of these basis vectors that forms that basis vector there. And we're interested now in those coefficients here. This map from this basis to that basis is called a Bogoliubov transformation. And it plays the same role as the time evolution in the Schrödinger picture would. Because remember that in the Schrödinger picture is the state that evolves. In the Heisenberg picture is the operators that evolve. And here we are describing how the eigenbasis of these operators therefore evolves. This is the map from the early eigenbasis to the late eigenbasis. Once we can express this vector in terms of the new basis, the late basis, we can of course express every in vector in that basis, because we simply need to act with a dagger in on this multiple times in order to get the 1, the 2, the 3 in states. And how the a in vectors act, we know how the a in vectors, no, the a in operators, we know how they act on these vectors, but we also know how they act on those vectors, because we can express the a in terms of the a out. They just differ by a constant. All right, so we want to calculate those lambda in, and we will in a moment. But let's first ask, what are we going to gain if we do it? What can we calculate if we find those lambda n? What is the meaning of these lambda n coefficients? But remember that the system's state is frozen. And we said for simplicity, we might assume that the quantum field started out in a vacuum state. So the quantum state of the field might be gamma, which is zero in. So it's a vacuum state early. It doesn't have to be, but of course, it's just a convenient choice. And then, let's say we measure at a time t after the driving force has finished, we measure the energy. That is, we measure the Hamiltonian. We measure this guy. Right, so at late times, the Hamiltonian is this, omega a dagger out, a out plus 1/2. So we measure that observable at late times. And what we're going to find is an eigenvalue of the Hamiltonian. Right, whenever you measure an observable, the outcome of the measurement is one of the eigenvalues of that observables. And we know what the eigenvalues are of the Hamiltonian at late times. They are, you know, n plus 1/2 times omega. So we're going to get one of those, and the state will then collapse into the corresponding eigenstate. So we started out in the ground state, and then we measure the energy, which is to say we measure whether the action of the driving force managed to excite our harmonic oscillator. So we started the harmonic oscillator in the ground state, the driving force acts, then we measure the energy, and we find, for example, the fifth excited state, or the seventh excited state or something. There's going to be a probability distribution for finding the system afterwards in the fifth, the seventh, in the nth excited state. What is that probability distribution? So the probability amplitude for finding the state n out, if we measure the Hamiltonian at late times, the probability amplitude for finding the state n out at a time after the driving force ends is the overlap between gamma, the state in which the system actually is in, such as zero in, for example, that might be a good choice, and the state that we're looking for. Right? So the system is in that state, and we are asking whether, now that we measure, it is in that state. So that's the overlap. That's the probability amplitude and the actual probability for the transition from the initial state, which is the ground state of the harmonic oscillator, into the nth excited state later on. That probability is simply the modulus squared of the probability amplitude. So what is this then? What is the overlap between the state of the quantum system and n out? Now, if the state of the quantum system is prepared to be the ground state, the initial ground state, then this is the overlap we need to calculate. But remember, zero in is this linear combination of the out states. Okay? By definition, these lambdas are exactly that. So we basically have the this is this, right? That was the definition of the Bogle-Liebig transformation. We know that the zero n is some linear combination of these guys, and we don't know what the values of the lambdas are, but they must exist. And then we see that the overlap of these two vectors is given by that inner product here. And clearly, this is only non-zero. The terms in this sum all go away, except for one, namely when m is equal to n. And therefore, we just get, this is a Kronecker delta of n and m, and we get one contribution for the lambda n. So the probability amplitude for the transition from the ground state to the nth excited state is given by lambda. And the modulus square of it is the probability for that excitation to happen. In quantum field theory, of course, this will be the probability for finding n particles of a particular momentum, if the oscillator in question is the oscillator for a particular momentum. And we're asking, you know, how successful was the charge in exciting n particles of a particular momentum, in creating n particles of a particular momentum. So now let's calculate these coefficients lambda n, which are the excitation probabilities. Let's do it the mathematician's way. I give you the solution and then we prove it's right. We could also do it systematically, the way physicists usually do it, by deriving it, but it would be more tedious. So let's just write down what the solution is and then convince ourselves it's right. So the lambda n's, these coefficients, are now claimed to be e to the power minus 1/2 j naught squared, and then 1 over square root of n factorial j naught to the power n. You can see that the size of the j naught is important in this. So the claim, therefore, is that the zero in vector, I mean, this claim is equivalent to the claim that the zero in vector is this linear combination of the n out vectors. Remember, this is a basis. These are the lambdas, right? Okay, so it's claimed that these are the linear combination coefficients. Now we need to check two things to convince ourselves that that's true. First, we need to check that the defining condition of the vector n in, a zero in, is obeyed. You see, the claim is that this linear combination is zero in. If that's true, it ought to be annihilated by the operator a in, because that's how the ground state is defined of the harmonic oscillator at early times. So if this is true, then when a in is applied to it, it must be zero. So a in applied to this has to be zero. And secondly, we need to check that this is not just pointing in the right direction, but also has this, the right length. It needs to be normalized vector. Zero in has, the vector zero in has length one. Okay, let's start with the non-trivial bit, not the normalization, but that it's actually the vector that's annihilated by a in. Now, it's a little difficult to act with a in on this, because a in acts on n out non-trivially. So it's useful to rewrite a in terms of a out, which we can do. Right? A in is simply a out minus j naught. So to check whether this vector is annihilated by a in, as it ought to be, we can check whether it's annihilated by a out minus j naught. So this is what we need to check. So let's try that. So we apply a in onto that vector here, this one. and see if it's zero. Now, what do we get? This is a term that doesn't depend on n. It's just some number which we can pull in front of that series. That's what we do here. We just pull this in front of the series. And now we have this acting here onto that series. Here, let us write the n out in terms of what it is defined as. It is defined to be 1 over square root of n factorial, a dagger out to the nth power acting on the zero out state. Remember? So all we do is we substitute for n out its expression in terms of applying the a dagger operator multiple times on the zero out state. Now we have 1 over square root of n factorial inherited from here, and another one comes from expressing the n out in terms of a dagger out acting on zero out. So we have the product of 2 of those square roots. And that means we get simply 1 over n factorial, which is convenient because, let's look at it. We have here a series where we have something to the power n, something to the power n, and then we divide by n factorial. That looks very much like an exponential. Okay. So it's an exponential. So we have to show now that this is equal to zero, right? You try to show that a in acting on this candidate vector is zero. So we have to show that this is zero. So we have here the a out, which is an operator, multiplying this operator here, e to the power j naught a dagger out. Minus j naught times this operator. Now, from this line to that line, we carry forward this expression here. But we will do something to that. We use the fact that a times b, if a and b are operators, a times b is the commutator of a b plus b a. Trivial, right? Let's just spell out what it is. This is a b minus b a. So, trivially, that's true. So we use that here, with this playing the role of capital A and that playing the role of capital B. So we have here the commutator between the one operator and the other operator plus that. It's exactly this case here. The point is that if we do this, that term is going to go away because we have the A out acting on the zero out. So again, we're carrying forward. We're carrying forward. Okay, so. Okay, so we have to evaluate the commutator, and I'll show you in a moment how to do that. And we have. Did I miss a term here? It's over here. Okay, it's fine. Right, so that term here with the minus j naught here is here, right? It's minus j naught, that term. So this term moved over here. That term is this one. And we had to evaluate that commutator. That commutator is no longer here. Instead, that commutator turns out to be this commutator here turns out to be j naught times this. Now, how do we see this? There is a general theorem that if you don't know it yet, you absolutely need to put it into your toolbox. Whenever you have two operators, A and A dagger, that obey these commutation relations, and then you need to evaluate the commutator between A and F of A dagger, as we do here, here's an A, and here's some F of A dagger, namely the exponentiation of A dagger. Whenever you have to evaluate the commutator between A and some function of A dagger, then this turns out to be the derivative of this function of A dagger. Have you seen this before? Everybody seen this before? I'll give you a hint so that you can, you need to prove this once. There are two ways to do this. One is to do it for polynomials. Assume that your function f has a Taylor expansion, and then you do it for every term in this Taylor expansion, for every monomial in that Taylor expansion. You can just commute then the a with a dagger to the power n, and you will find that it is n times a dagger to the power n minus 1. Therefore, the derivative. And then by linearity, you get it for the entire power series. But there's another way to see this. You see, the derivative operator and the multiplication operator have as their commutator 1. See that? This works exactly the same way that A and A dagger work. And how do we see that this is true? Well, let's apply it. Dx x psi of x minus x dx psi of x. I think we had that on the board before, right? In any case, the point is that this is two terms. We get a term where the dx is differentiating the x by the product rule, right? Because we're differentiating the product of two functions here. We get one term where we differentiate this x and leave the psi of x alone. So it's just psi of x. But we also, let me write it here. This is psi of x and another term where it is plus x dx psi of x, right? So that's what this becomes. And then we carry this forward. This is minus x dx psi of x. So this is psi of A. So therefore, these guys obey the same commutation relations as the A and A daggers. You can use them to represent the A and A daggers. The abstract A and A daggers can not only be represented in terms of matrices, infinite by infinite matrices, but also in terms of these guys. And using this, you can then show that if you have d by dx commutator f of x, this is f prime of x. And all we're claiming here is that this is true for the A and A daggers, obeying the same commutation relations. You just have to prove this for all monomials. The underlying, just as a comment, underlying all of this is that differentiation need not be defined the way that Newton and Leibniz did it. They defined differentiation by taking this limit, epsilon going to 0 of f of x plus epsilon minus f of x divided by epsilon. You don't have to. There's an alternative to this, which is based on the fact that differentiation obeys the product rule, the Leibniz rule. If all you know is that your operation obeys the Leibniz rule, you can already differentiate up to a prefactor. So differentiation can be defined algebraically. And a lot of derivatives in, let's say, differential geometry today defines many derivatives in that way, algebraically rather than analytically, because algebraic is more robust than analytic. It's also quite satisfying to define things algebraically because you don't have to take a limit for, let's say, epsilon going to zero. Because if the x variable that we're dealing with is space, is distances, and we don't want to take limits for epsilon going to zero, because that would mean distances that are arbitrarily small. How do we know that that notion makes sense? Probably it makes no sense. down to, I mean, at scale smaller than 10 to the minus 35 meters because of quantum gravity. Therefore, it's good to have a notion of differentiation that doesn't rely on the assumption that we can take limits for distances going to zero. It's just algebraic through commutation relations. So here we are simply appealing to differentiation to quickly see that what we get is a derivative. But ultimately, it's deeper. This can be viewed as more fundamental than differentiation, at least more robust than the differentiation that Newton and Leibniz came up with. All right, so what we had to do was to evaluate this commutator here, A, and a function of A dagger, which is exactly this business there. But what is the derivative of e to the power j naught A dagger with respect to A dagger? Well, here we have it. The commutator between A and this function of A dagger is the derivative of this function of A dagger with respect to A dagger, and it's just j naught times the exponential there. You can do it by writing out what the exponential is in terms of a sum of monomials, Taylor expansion, and then do it for every term separately. But because it's just like differentiation, you can also see directly that this is what you have to get. All right, so what we then got is that this term gives us that. That's the term here with the plus j naught. But we also had the term minus j naught from over here. So those two guys cancel each other. We're just left with this one. But this term has, well, it has A daggers in it, but the A out is to the right. So the A out annihilates that vector. And so we get the zero length vector here, and this can't do anything about it. It's always the zero length vector. So we proved that the proposition is true, namely that the vector that we wrote down is in fact annihilated by A in. What we have not shown is that it's normalized. And I leave it to you as an exercise to work out that this prefactor here, e to the power minus 1/2 j naught squared, is in fact exactly the term you need, such that this vector has length 1. In order to prove that, you have to calculate this, which means you have to take this and then calculate the inner product with itself. And then, well, see if you can work that out. It's not that hard. All right, so now we've done these individual mode oscillators that were individually driven by the external classical driving force. Let's now put them all together again to get the quantum field. So we had this classical driving force, just like a cork on a string that we were dangling in the water, and in this way we can create waves in the water, for example. Or we can also drag it through the water and make waves. We will find analogs of that in the quantum theory too, like charges that we send around in space and time. So similar to what we have here with the water waves would be what an electron does. Now let's put it all together again. The Hamiltonian of a quantum field driven by a classical distribution of charges and currents is given in this way. And remember that the roles played here are this, that phi hat is a simplified version of the electromagnetic field, and the J of X and D is a simplified version of a current of electrons that would normally be described by the Dirac equation, or in this case, classical Dirac equation, classical, or simply just classical currents, just describe where the current is. So for example, you could choose J of X and T to be the charge of an electron times the delta function of the position minus a position as a function of time. In this way, you can describe an electron's trajectory. So you have a classical electron that obeys some classical trajectory, classical charge, and then the J of X and T would simply take that form. It's the charge times a Dirac delta of where it is. And then you can plug it in here and calculate through. and that's how that would look like. We consider the case where the J is, let's say, zero outside a certain time interval. So our charge is doing its thing only for a finite amount of time. Then we have again, and we have in operators and out operators. And at the early times, before the charge does its thing, we have a free, undriven quantum field theory. And at late times, after the charge has done its thing, we also have a free, undriven quantum field theory. And in each case, the Hamiltonian just takes this simple form. Remember that we're in the Heisenberg picture here. And the equations that we need to solve are the equations for a free quantum field, right? Before the charge acts and after the charge acts, it's just a free quantum field theory. All we have to solve is the Klein-Gordon equation, the canonical commutations relations. And in order to do so, we do a Fourier transform. And then the Klein-Gordon equation takes this form. And the canonical commutation relations take that form. And we have the hermeticity condition in space translating into this Fourier transformed version of the hermeticity condition, which is that phi k dagger is phi minus k. Remember, it means that after the Fourier transform, the field is no longer self-adjoint operator valued. If we work in an infrared cutoff scenario, so we put the system into a box, then these k's are going to be discrete. So following Fock, the solution strategy now for the quantum field theory is this, that we proceed very analogously to the individual driven harmonic oscillators. We start by introducing new variables. Oh, there should be a k here. In quantum mechanics, for one harmonic oscillator, we had an a, and the a variable was defined to be a linear combination of the q hat and the p hat. And remember, we chose these in principle arbitrary coefficients. We had complete freedom in choosing them, but we chose these to satisfy two conditions of convenience. We chose these two prefactors here in such a way that the commutation relations between A and A dagger come out to be one. And we chose them in such a way that the Hamiltonian of the harmonic oscillator of frequency omega takes this simple form where it's simply A dagger A plus 1/2. Omega times A dagger A plus 1/2. Which also means, remember that this would not be the right choice of coefficients if we worked with a harmonic oscillator of a different frequency. Or indeed, if the harmonic oscillator simply changes its frequency because we parametrically drive it. So we will have to come back to the fact that these coefficients here may not be optimal all the time. It's there's only one fixed good choice forever if the harmonic oscillator doesn't change. And we adjust the omega to the harmonic oscillator that we have. In quantum field theory, then, we operate exactly the same way. We define operators AK in the same way, such that, again, the canonical commutation relations come out to be simple, and we're just having a one on the right-hand side, while in some textbooks, you might find that they make a different choice, where the A and A dagger operators on the right-hand side have not a one or a Kronecker delta or Dirac delta, but instead, they have some functions of omega in there. That's because these authors want to, I don't know, confuse everybody. But just keep in mind that in some textbooks, they make different choices. And that's okay, because these are variables that are introduced for convenience, right? We want to deal with one variable rather than two. And we can do this because the real part and the imaginary part of these variables correspond to the phi and the pi. Then the equations of motion and the canonical commutation relations behave very similarly. In quantum mechanics, we simply have the equation of motion at A dot is minus I omega A, which obviously has these exponential solutions. And now in quantum field theory, it's going to be exactly the same story, we now have the A dot k being minus I omega k ak of t. The canonical commutation relations are these in quantum mechanics and quantum field theory. We have multiples of those, and they have these commutators here. And then, right, all of these things work all very well as long as the omega is constant. But later in quantum field theory on curved space-time, it will not be the case. But what we can do in the case of curved space-time is that we again look at an in period and an out period. Imagine space-time is not expanding, it's not doing anything funny, so the omegas are constant for a while. Then it's this kind of simple quantum field theory. And then, instead of having a driving force, there's going to be a period in which the space-time is expanding. The curvature is doing things. And then that period comes to an end, and the universe starts coasting again, and it's just, you know, nothing dramatic happens, no time dependence in the omegas. So we will again have an in period and out period. We can again calculate Bogoliubov coefficients, Bogoliubov transform from the eigenbase of the Hamiltonian onion early to the Hamiltonian. So the eigenbase of the Hamiltonian late. All right, so we want to solve this now, the canonical commutation relations and the equations of motion. In quantum mechanics, we found that the A of t is, remember this is the early period before the driving kicks in. A of t is simply this phase factor times some early A in operator that obeys these commutation relations, and then the same is true for the quantum field theory. And explicitly, we find that in quantum mechanics, once we have the solution, now let me keep it up, we found that once we have the solution, once we have A of t, we can make use of the fact that A of t contains the information about x and p, about q and p, about positions and momenta. The real part, the self-adjoint part of A was the position, and the anti-self-adjoint part was the momentum. And so indeed, we can express, for example, the position operator as a function of time as the self-adjoint part of the A operator, right? It's the A in plus A in dagger. It's just like in complex analysis where you have that the real part is A plus A star. This is just the self-adjoint part here. And then the pi hat of t would be obtained as I times this with a minus sign in here. And similarly, in quantum field theory, once we have the solution to our quantum field theory in terms of the A, which is super simple, we can then re-express, we can use this to express the variables that we're really interested in, which is the field and the canonically conjugate field, we can express those in terms of the A, k, and a k dagger, and that's what it is here. So again, the field amplitude is the self-adjoint part of the A and A dagger operator. And the canonically conjugate field pi k hat is the anti-self-adjoint part. So now we've expressed the field in terms of the A and A dagger operators on the level of the individual harmonic oscillators. Remember that we have after Fourier transform, we have for every point in momentum space an independent harmonic oscillator. That's why we did the Fourier transform, because then we could solve for every one of those modes the equation of motion separately, because it's an independent harmonic oscillator. That was the solution. We plugged it in here, and then we have the amplitude of these harmonic oscillators, the phi hat of k. But ultimately, we're interested in the field, in the quantum field, as a function of x and t. So we can take the phi hat of k and now Fourier transform back into the position space. And then you see that we get more terms here. We get an integral over, this stuff is still here, but we also have the Fourier transform from k space to x space. So we get extra terms, e to the power ikx and e to the power minus ikx from the reverse Fourier transform here. So the phi hat of x and t is then all of this expression. We will encounter that expression next lecture too. Super important, because this is the solution for the free quantum field theory in terms of A and A dagger operators. time-dependent solution. So when, for example, in the next lecture then, we study at what rate an atom might emit a photon, we will do this in the interaction picture. And in the interaction picture, the operators will evolve according to the free theory. So even though the quantum field and the atom are interacting with each other, there's an interaction Hamiltonian. The Dirac picture or interaction picture of the evolution will be such that the operators evolve according to the free theories, like the quantum field theory, and that is the free solution that we will then import there, that we will use there. And then the states will evolve according to the Schrödinger equation, where the interaction Hamiltonian is in the Heisenberg picture. Remember how that works. If you're not familiar with how exactly the interaction picture, or also called the Dirac picture, work, check out my lecture notes on quantum mechanics, where there's a chapter on exactly how that's defined. We will need this in the next lecture. Okay, so that's something that we will need next time. So what's the Hilbert space of states now? Analogous to the case of quantum mechanics that we covered earlier in this lecture, there is a vector zero in our Hilbert space, which obeys that it is annihilated by all of the annihilation operators A in K. And so now we have infinitely many harmonic oscillators, and there's going to be a state that's annihilated by all of them. Technically, the full Hilbert space is the tensor product of the Hilbert spaces of all of the harmonic oscillators. So therefore, the zero-in state of the collection of all these harmonic oscillators is the tensor product of the zero-in states of each one of these harmonic oscillators. So there's zero-in states for each K, for each harmonic oscillator, and then the zero-in state without reference to K is the tensor product of all of them. That's a state in the full Hilbert space. Each of those just lives in the Hilbert space of one of these harmonic oscillators, one mode. So then, how does the Hamiltonian look like of this quantum field theory? Well, it's pi squared plus phi squared, as usual. We had this before. In terms of the A and A dagger operators, we can now write it as the integral over the omega k, and then we have A daggers A plus 1/2, plus where the individual harmonic oscillators had just a term 1/2 here, multiplied with Kronecker deltas of k and k prime, we now have a Dirac delta here evaluated at zero. That's an infinity here. That infinity is an infrared divergence. If we had put our system into a big box, then this would be a large number, but it would be finite. So in a box, we can write our Hamiltonian as L to the power minus 3/2. That's just the normalization that comes out. And then instead of the integral over all modes, we have the sum over all modes, because only discrete points in momentum space are now occurring. And then we have the sum over the omega k, A dagger, A plus 1/2. And you see that there's a divergence in this. Because we have a sum over all of these omega k, over all k, and then this 1/2 here. And that sum over that 1/2 is an infinity, which is an ultraviolet divergence. We will see more about this later on. For now, let me just remind you that when the Hamiltonian, when if we add to the Hamiltonian a number times the identity operator. See, Hamiltonian is this non-trivial business plus a number times the identity operator. That never affects the dynamics. Because whatever you add in the Hamiltonian, if it's just a multiple of the identity operator, it will commute with all observables. So the dynamics of observables is not going to be affected. And strangely, it seems to be an infinity that multiplies the identity, but it's still commuting with all observables, so it doesn't matter. That's not the case in gravity, because in gravity, the absolute value of the energy matters. See, if the sun was much more energetic, if the sun had more energy, it would have more mass, it would attract the Earth more, and our orbit would be different, would be faster. So it does make a difference in gravity. Okay, now after the driving ends, we obtain that the AK of T solutions are just multiples of A out K with these phase factors, just as we saw it happen for the individual oscillators. And just as we saw it for the individual oscillators, we still have for every mode that the A out operator is the A in operator plus a J naught of K, where J naught of K is again the Fourier component of the driving force evaluated at the frequency of the harmonic oscillator. But now we have, of course, harmonic oscillators of virtually every frequency. Right? For a given K, we have an omega of K. It's important because it means that if you have a driving force which has predominantly a particular frequency, then it will predominantly excite the modes whose omega matches that frequency. Again, we see the phenomenon of resonance in here. Now we can proceed as we did for a single harmonic oscillator. We can construct the n-out basis, starting with the zero-out vector that's annihilated by the a-out operator. And then we can calculate the overlap between the zero-in state and the n-out state. So we can ask, if we prepare the quantum field in the vacuum state, no particles, then after the driving ends, what's the probability, amplitude, or the probability for finding n particles of momentum k? That's what we need to calculate. And of course, the calculation proceeds exactly as we did before. You calculate the lambdas, the capital lambda coefficients, exactly the same way as before. All right, so we can do all of this now. So what did we describe here? We described the situation where, in analogy to the water, we have some charges or current. Let's say we have a charge that we drag through the vacuum in order to create electromagnetic waves or photons. In the case of water, it would be like dragging a cork through the water, and it will make waves as you do this. Here it would be like a charge, like the electron described by J of X and T. Now, let's upgrade that. So remember, so far, we studied free quantum field theory, and then quantum field theory driven by classical charges and currents. Now, let's study quantum field theory driven by quantum charges and currents. The full story would be to do two interacting quantum field theories. After all, the electron is to be described by a quantum field. Proton is described by a quantum field. All particles are described by quantum fields. And ultimately, it's always quantum field theoretical harmonic oscillators that drive each other. In practice, however, that tends to be very tedious. You would not calculate, normally, the decay rate of an excited hydrogen atom describing the excited hydrogen atom with quantum field theory, because it's a very complicated state. The fifth excited state of the hydrogen atom in quantum field theory would be very complicated. You have to write down the quantum field theory of the proton, which itself consists of quarks, and then the quantum field theory of the electron, and write down the interaction Hamiltonian between them, and then try to find the bound state of that system in this big Hilbert space of these two quantum field theories. And these bound states tend to be non-perturbative, so it's very difficult to do these calculations. In principle, you can do such things, and in order to get very high precision results, you may have to do this. But in practice, like for chemistry, you don't need the 15th digit behind the comma. And then what you can do is take a first quantized system, such as a hydrogen atom in the usual first quantized formulation, and couple it to a quantum field, like the electromagnetic field. And then you can calculate excitation, absorption and emission processes. So the analog here would be this. Imagine you have water, and now you have a system that you use to excite water waves. But let's allow the system that excites the water waves itself to be excitable. So let's say we take this cork and we cut it in half. And then the two halves we wire up with a piece of string so that there's a spring between the two. So imagine this cork in isolation. I've cut it into two pieces and then I connect them by attaching a spring on one end and a spring and the spring, same spring at the other end also into the cork. So now these two halves of the cork can oscillate against each other, which means that this cork now has an internal degree of freedom. I could, for example, press the two halves together of this cork and then let go. Then they will jump apart again and start oscillating because of the spring between them. So what I could do now is, I can now use two methods to excite water waves here. I can take this cork without its internal oscillations, just at rest, and I drag it through the water to make waves. I can do that. But I can also take this piece of cork and excite it internally. So I press it together and then let go and it oscillates. So I pull it apart and let go and it oscillates, right? And then I take this cork and just drop it in the water softly. So it's not the dropping that makes waves. It's that the cork is locally messing with the water that makes waves. Similarly, you can take an ion, like you ionize helium or whatever, and then you can have it go on an orbit somewhere, complicated curve in space and time, that will act like an antenna, it will create photons. But instead, you could also take your ion, your helium plus, and get it into an excited state, and then have it decay. It's just like this cork losing its internal energy to the creation of waves. So similarly, here you would have that the excited atom or molecule or ion loses some of its internal energy, internal excitation energy, for the creation of waves in the field, for the creation of photons in the field. So how would we describe that? So far, we looked at Hamiltonians of this form, where it's the usual Hamiltonian, free Hamiltonian of the quantum field, and then we add to it an interaction Hamiltonian with external driving force J, which didn't have a hat. Now we upgrade that and we put a hat over it to indicate this is going to be some sort of quantum system here, which has its own Hilbert space. So that the Hilbert space now is much bigger. It's going to be the Hilbert space of the field, tensored with the Hilbert space of that system that couples to the field, which might be an atom or a molecule or some ion. So, for example, the J of X and T could be, in a very simple model, some operator that's a function of time, and then a Dirac delta that describes the location of where our system is, such as where our atom is. So this could be describing the location as a function of time of the center of mass of an atom, and that would be some internal excitation degree of freedom of that atom. And then you can upgrade that also to allow for the quantumness of the center of mass. Here, the center of mass of the atom is described classically, but you can also upgrade that to make that quantum as well. Just a few days ago, a paper with a student of mine was accepted on phenomena that arise when you do this. So the total Hilbert space is then going to be the Hilbert space of the atom tensor the Hilbert space of the field. So effectively, we get a Hamiltonian, which is the sum of the Hamiltonian of the quantum field plus the interaction Hamiltonian plus, in principle, the Hamiltonian of our atom. So we are mixing first and second quantization here. Nothing prevents us from doing this. We simply have multiple systems. One of these systems is, let's say, hydrogen atom. Another of this system might be a quantum field, and each one has its free Hamiltonian, each one has its observables, each one has its Hilbert space, and we can have them interact with each other if we can write down the interaction Hamiltonian between them. Now, these charged systems can act as emitters and receivers of waves, just as we discussed. When you have a quark sitting in the water that is not excited, it's just sitting there, and then a water wave comes along, that water wave can actually excite the quark a little bit. And vice versa. If there are no waves in the water and the quark is excited, then it can create waves. And so similarly here in the quantum field, you can have an atom in an excited state in the electromagnetic field in the vacuum, and then that atom can emit a photon, or conversely, the atom might start out in its ground state and then absorb a photon. And this process can be described in quantum field theory because we now have the interaction between the quantum field on one hand and the atom on the other hand. So remember, as I said at the very beginning of this lecture today, if you have an atom described in first quantization and not coupled to anything, then if it's in an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, an excited state of the Hamiltonian, it's going to never decay because it's in eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. But it will decay if you couple it to a field such as the electromagnetic field, because what is an eigenstate to the hydrogen atom, or any other atom for that matter, what is an eigenstate for that atom alone is not going to be an eigenstate for the total Hamiltonian, which is the Hamiltonian of the atom plus the Hamiltonian of the quantum field plus the interaction Hamiltonian. Therefore, there's going to be an evolution away from that eigenstate, and it will be an evolution into the atom decaying and photons being around. Now, you might think, okay, that's all fine, but I could have predicted that, that's easy, right? So all we see here is that, yeah, light can be absorbed, light can be emitted. But there's more to it. It turns out that when an atom is in its ground state and just sitting there, and the field is in its vacuum state, then you would expect that the atom doesn't suddenly get excited. If the atom is moving around at a constant velocity, then you can always go into its rest frame and conclude the same. It shouldn't get excited. But what if the atom is accelerated? It turns out that if you accelerate an atom, then it acquires the probability for getting excited. And that's what we will discuss next time. This is of fundamental importance. First of all, we need to consider why an inertial atom could not, and why an accelerated atom can get excited from the acceleration. You see, imagine you had an atom that is just inertially moving about. Then you might imagine that it might spontaneously get excited, and the energy comes from its motion. It would simply go slower then. Kinetic energy would be transformed into excitation. That is not possible, because you could go into the rest frame of your particle, and then it has no kinetic energy to give. Right? So that cannot happen. But if the atom is accelerated, then somebody must accelerate that particle. There must be an agent that supplies a force and an energy, and a force and energy and power to accelerate that particle. And it turns out that that agent is prone to giving that particle energy to get excited. Now, that has fundamental implications. Because as we discussed at the beginning of this lecture, the notion of particle is a quite non-trivial one in quantum field theory, because the decomposition of a quantum field into harmonic oscillators is not canonical. It's not unique. Here, in the case of Minkowski space, it was. There was a unique choice for doing this. And therefore, we had a unique choice of, well, once we had a unique choice of harmonic oscillators for the modes, we could simply say, having five particles means that five of these harmonic oscillators are excited. But what if there is no unique choice of these mode oscillators? Then the very notion of particle is ambiguous in that sense. It's relative to which of these modes you choose. So therefore, the definition of Unruh and de Witt is quite useful to say that, wait a moment, particles should be defined, the notion of particle should be defined more carefully as what particle detectors detect. So the idea would be to say, how do I know I have a photon? Well, I have a photon if I can absorb it. Right? So if an atom at rest is unexcited, prepared in the ground state, and then it gets into the excited state, then it must have absorbed a photon. So we say we detected the photon. And therefore, the probability distribution for this or that photon to exist can be related to the probability distribution of detecting this or that photon. So the existence of particles, such as photons, can be related to their ability to trigger detectors. And the detector could be as simple as just a simple atom or molecule. Of course, it could also be a big machine, but ultimately it's just the initial kick that the photon does on matter that matters here. But you see, this too is non-trivial, as we just saw, or as we will see and calculate in the next lecture. Because even if the quantum field is in a vacuum state, as far as we are concerned in the Minkowski space vacuum, an accelerated atom may click. It may, as detector, it may click. It may get excited. Which means that an accelerated observer will insist that there are particles, when a non-accelerated observer will say there aren't any. And you can even have the opposite too, that an accelerated observer will say there are no particles, but an observer at rest will say there are. So the notion, very notion of particle is very, very difficult to define in quantum field theory. We have circumstances, limiting cases where it's all well defined. But in general, it's probably fair to say that there is no unique notion of what a particle is, which is quite dramatic. Because if you consider particle physics as it is done at CERN, particle physics where they smash particles into each other, they generally hold the opposite view. They would say the only thing that we can ever know of a quantum field is its particles that we shoot in and the particles that come out. And they say, we've never seen a quantum field. We've only ever seen clicks in detectors. But now, from the perspective of quantum field theory, in circumstances where we have accelerations, and then by the equivalence principle, accelerations can be replaced by curvature, by gravity, in those situations, we see that the very notion of a particle falls apart. So the particle physicists, high-energy particle physicists, would tell you that there's only the particle picture, and you shouldn't think of quantum fields as waves, as fields. But as we will see in quantum field theory to cosmology, the field view is actually more robust than the particle view. Because from the field, you can calculate the impact on the energy momentum tensor, which tells you what the impact on curvature is and what the cosmic microwave background will look like. We've never seen any infraton particles, but we believe we've seen the effect of the infraton field in terms of its fluctuations. So overall, the issue is not settled. It could well be that the particle picture as well as the field picture needs to be replaced by something more fundamental, more robust. Okay, so next time, the Unruh effect and light-matter interaction, emission, absorption of particles, that sort of thing.